Thanks, David, and thank you all for coming here. I realize this is the first night of the film festival, and the weather hasn't been so great, so I triply appreciate your presence here. The talk that I want to give this evening is about the role of amateur scientists and other ordinary citizens at the start of the space age. And some of you in the audience will remember what tonight's talk is about because you were there when some of it happened. And others like me were born after and became intrigued about it through history books and stories that we heard from our parents. And it's especially timely because at the end of this month, we will celebrate the 50th anniversary of the launch of America's first satellite on January 31st. And of course, last October, we had Sputnik's 50th birthday. I want to start with a basic question. And the question is, how do we remember the start of the space age? It's a fairly simple question. And for those of you who go to the bookstore or see movies, there have been a lot of documentaries and popular books about the start of the space age and detailing the story of the space race and how the Soviets and the Americans competed with each other. But the people who come to mind in these traditional stories are astronauts and rocket scientists and engineers and people like that. People like Wernher von Braun, shown here, with James Van Allen and William Pickering, the director of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at that time, holding aloft a model of Explorer 1, America's first satellite. And if it's not the scientists and engineers, perhaps it's the cool-headed men in the white shirts with the pocket protectors at Mission Control that we remember, or that we've seen in movies like Apollo 13, or perhaps it's the Mercury 7 astronauts who in the 1960s were turned into new American heroes, sort of a blend of Davy Crockett and Boy Scouts. But how we remember the start of the space age is almost always through the activities of professionals. And in some ways, this isn't surprising because the post-war media after 1945 depicted scientists as heroic explorers and science as a majestic adventure. And the symbols of post-war science, of course, were quite grand. Think of the 200-inch telescope on Palomar Mountain with its classically shaped dome. I mean, what could be a grander symbol of science than that? And before the widespread disenchantment with science and technology that took hold in the late 1960s, launching satellites and exploring space did indeed seem triumphant and a very glorious sort of endeavor. However, the start of the space age also provided an invitation for amateur scientists and other curious citizens to come along for the ride and actively participate. And when Sputnik appeared, ordinary people around the world, homemakers, teenagers, bankers, janitors, school teachers, all had an opportunity to play an important role. And tonight's talk is about their story. Amateur science, like professional science, was part of the bonanza of science popularization that emerged after World War II. As the public recognized the role of scientists in securing victory, their prestige after 1945 rose dramatically. Harper's Magazine commented in 1945, "Scientists are in vogue these days. No dinner party is a success without at least one physicist to explain the nature of the new age in which we live." In this story, the public is typically portrayed as a passive participant, reading about science in newspapers, wondering what it all meant. However, not everyone was an onlooker, just reading about it. And the participation of amateur scientists has largely been left out of the picture. Historians and journalists have largely viewed the start of the space age from the top down: astronauts, engineers, politicians, military leaders. Tonight I want to reverse the focus and look from the bottom up at people like this woman shown here, who were science enthusiasts, but they were not household names like Wernher von Braun. The entree for these citizen scientists to take part in this adventure came as professional scientists were gearing up for the International Geophysical Year. The IGY, as it was known in the 1950s, was the most ambitious science project of the 20th century. From July 1957 to December 1958, tens of thousands of professional scientists from 67 different countries manned hundreds of stations around the planet. And during the IGY, scientists gained a remarkable new picture of our planet. For instance, they detected the Van Allen radiation belts around the Earth, they explored the polar regions, they explored the Earth's oceans. the IGY also provided opportunities for amateur scientists of all interests, ham radio operators, meteor spotters, amateur weather observers, all participated in IGY-related activities and stimulated interest among ordinary citizens to explore science's endless frontier. However, what dominated headlines and dining room conversation during this period before the IGY began was the announcement in the summer of 1955 that the United States would launch the world's first satellites. Of course, American politicians and the American public naively assumed that the U.S. would be first in space. And when the first Sputniks surprised the world in the autumn of 1957, the United States' professional tracking networks were not fully prepared. For several months, the only global system in place to visually spot these new satellites were these teams of amateur scientists that I'll be speaking of. These amateur scientists were part of a program called Operation Moonwatch. This was a volunteer program that the Smithsonian started in 1956, as engineers in the United States and the Soviet Union were drawing up plans for the first satellites. Moonwatch lasted for 2 decades. In the opening months of the space age, it provided a glorious opportunity for citizen scientists around the planet to participate. And what distinguished these moon watchers from their curious neighbors was that they were not just passive consumers of science popularization. As dedicated observers and tinkerers, moon watchers actively worked with professional scientists to help produce new knowledge. And while the first Soviet satellites alarmed many Westerners, moon watchers had a different reaction. They looked forward to the great adventure space exploration promised and to the broader horizons that beckoned to their children. Moonwatch served as a global satellite spotting system. The information that its members collected and shared with professionals was valuable for many reasons. Scientists, for example, in the 1950s lacked precise information on the nature of the upper atmosphere, its temperature, its density. They lacked precise information about the exact shape of the Earth, even. And meanwhile, the military, as it was beginning to build rockets that could carry nuclear weapons from, say, Kansas to Kiev, needed information on how they would behave as they entered the atmosphere. As a result, Moonwatcher's work also had implications not just for science, but for national security at the time. And Moonwatch as a program drew upon many different aspects of Cold War culture. One was the Ground Observer Corps. These were the volunteers who scanned the skies for enemy airplanes during the 1950s. Many Americans at this time period feared a nuclear strike delivered by Soviet aircraft. And in this climate of hyper-awareness, military and civil defense groups encouraged American citizens to be watchful for enemy aircraft which could strike with little warning and devastating consequences. And in response, in the mid-1950s, hundreds of thousands of Americans, the patriotic and the paranoid alike, joined the Ground Observer Corps and maintained alertness against the Soviet bomber attack. The Corps combined watchfulness with strong elements of civic participation and, in some cases, a fair dose of Cold War suspicion. And in 1956, as an aside, when the program peaked, it had enlisted over 350,000 volunteers, manning some 17,000 posts up the coast of California, across the northern border with Canada, and down the East Coast. The appearance of Soviet satellites in American skies extended the general public's sphere of invasion into outer space. The Observer Corps provided a model for Moonwatch as the program planned its organization. A second group drawn to the program were science enthusiasts, including many teens and young adults who read about science, saw it depicted in movies and TV shows, and bought toys and hobby kits with science themes. Amateur scientists pursued their interests in geology and meteorology, rockets and astronomy with great zeal. And like automobile tail fins and hula hoops, the resurgence of hobbyist scientists after World War II reflected America's post-war economic prosperity. Budding investigators used their disposable income to buy telescopes and other instruments manufactured by many of the companies that opened up shop with the availability of war surplus equipment. And in addition, tens of thousands of people read Scientific American's monthly amateur science column. And among these amateur scientists, the community of amateur astronomers was especially vibrant. By the time Soviets launched Sputnik, there were over 200 astronomy clubs nationwide. These clubs were active in their local communities, involved with education and reaching out to the public, and the growth of these clubs was part of the 1950s pattern of civic engagement. You know, think of this as a time when membership in groups like Rotary and the Kiwanis Club peaked. A third group were children and teenagers. They were drawn to Moonwatch. And before the surprise of Sputnik, toy companies produced a wide range of science kits that helped stimulate scientific curiosity among children. Science fiction movies, the UFO craze of the early 1950s, all helped stimulate their interest. Think of the huge popularity of Mr. Wizard. Over 100,000 kids were members of one of 5,000 Mr. Wizard clubs that sprung up in the 1950s around the planet. And the fact that his assistants on his TV show were precocious children added to the show's long-lived popularity. And together, these three groups, vigilant citizens, amateur scientists, and science-oriented teens, became the basis for Moonwatch. Civic duty, the virtue of vigilance, intense public interest in science and space, the long tradition of amateur science in the United States, were all strands in this Cold War cultural tapestry, which taken together helped create the cloth from which Moonwatch was fashioned. And while Moonwatch was an activity for amateur scientists that organized at the grassroots, the person who championed it among professional scientists was Fred Whipple, a Harvard astronomer, famous in scientific circles for his studies of meteors and comets. And in 1955, Fred Whipple, at Harvard at this time, became the new director of the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory. He quickly transformed this once moribund institution, oversaw its move from Washington, D.C. to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he helped transform it into the world's largest organization in the 1960s for astronomy and space science. For years, Whipple had spoken publicly about the coming era of space exploration, and when Eisenhower announced that the U.S. would launch satellites for the IGY, the ambitious Whipple was ready. He quickly proposed that his observatory have responsibility for spotting and tracking these satellites. He saw this as an opportunity to carve out a place both for himself as well as his observatory and to bring resources to help it grow. Whipple understood that these new satellites would have to be visually tracked somehow and their orbits accurately predicted. Sure, they would have radio transmitters on board, but the electronics at this time were fragile and the batteries short-lived. The batteries on the first Soviet satellites, for example, only lasted for a few weeks. Plus, given the propaganda value of satellites, there was a special emphasis on securing real proof, actually seeing something, as opposed to recording mysterious radio signals. Therefore, visual tracking was essential. But the problem with this, as you all know, is that satellites are very hard to see. The first ones, of course, are quite small. Their orbits were unpredictable. In the 1950s, experts likened it to being able to see a golf ball tossed out of a jet plane, a task made harder if you don't know really where to look. So Whipple's bold plan depended on the cooperation and integration of three different ingredients. First, the Smithsonian would establish a network of a dozen specially designed cameras like the one shown here in the cover of Life magazine. These were called Baker Nunn cameras after the two men who designed them, and their wide-angle optics could view relatively large patches of the sky and photograph satellites as they passed overhead. And these 12 camera stations were plunked down all around the globe, Hawaii, Iran, India, Japan, South Africa, Australia. All had Baker Nunn stations, and they were manned by professionals. These camera stations, as the theory went, would send their information and photographs to the SAO back in Cambridge, where experts would crunch the numbers and predict the satellite orbits. And however, while the Baker Nunn cameras were expensive and sophisticated, scientists still needed to have a rough idea of where to look in the first place. And this is where Moonwatch entered the picture. Moonwatchers, as Whipple initially thought, would assist professionally manned Baker Nunn stations as well as the Navy's radio tracking stations. And the schematic Whipple drew up here gives some idea of the initial plan that amateurs would be part of the picture, but a relatively minor part. However, The Soviets, of course, had their own satellite program, and as you all know, beat the Americans into space. And during the opening weeks of the space age, this network of Baker-Nunn cameras wasn't complete. So moon watchers and other amateurs found themselves a much more essential part of this global tracking network than Whipple first imagined. So how did Moonwatch work? As I said, satellites aren't easy to spot, and with the first satellites, there were very few accurate predictions of when and where they might appear. So the idea behind Moonwatch was to arrange a group of properly positioned observers, overlapping their telescope's field of view, to create, in essence, a virtual picket fence across which a satellite's path would take it. So the idea was to go out and man your telescopes. When you thought a satellite was passing over, there would be this sort of imaginary line that everybody's telescope would sort of cover a particular patch of the sky. And the time and place at which you spotted a satellite would then be recorded and reported. Many Moonwatch teams oriented themselves around a mast with a crossbar on top of it, and this served as a reference point and alignment aid for the various team members. In this plan, an observer who saw a satellite would shout out a signal when it entered their telescope's field of view, and shout out another signal when the satellite was hidden by the mast's crossbar, and then a third signal when it left their telescope's field of view. Another team member would be tape recording these volunteers' calls, along with shortwave radio time signals broadcast by the National Bureau of Standards in Maryland. After the observing session ended, the team would replay the tape and, using stopwatches, get the sighting time down to about a tenth of a second, and then relay this information by telephone or telegram back to the Smithsonian Observatory in Cambridge, which would then plug it into its ongoing computer program to try to refine the orbital predictions. So the book that I have coming out, which tells all about this, is called Keep Watching the Skies. And I'm often asked, if that's your book's title, why are they looking down at their shoes? Many of you are amateur astronomers. You know that looking up for long periods of time is a pain in the neck. A typical Moonwatch telescope used a mirror, shown here, to reflect what was visible in the sky and to reflect that upwards into the observer's eye. This arrangement allowed for a moon watcher to view the sky comfortably for long periods of time. But it also explains why in photographs from this era, moon watchers are shown looking through instruments which look more like microscopes than telescopes. But it's simply a telescope looking down at a mirror with that mirror reflecting what is above it. The ideal telescope for satellite spotting was lightweight, inexpensive, small, rugged, few moving parts. Team members often built their own, or they could buy them from companies like Edmund Scientific in New Jersey for about $50. The satellite scope, which Edmund made, for example, featured optics which gave a wide field of view and magnified things about five times. The Smithsonian also provided dozens of what were called apogee telescopes, shown here in the lower right, to strategically located Moonwatch teams in New Mexico and Arizona and California, as well as sites in South Africa and Australia. These telescopes had greater magnification and light collecting ability, yet they had a smaller field of view. This meant that the observers using these had to be especially well trained and alert to make sure that a satellite passing overhead didn't elude them. The composition of Moonwatch teams in the United States was relatively diverse, at least in terms of its members' occupations. One newsletter from a Midwestern astronomy club says, "The thing about Moonwatch that intrigues us is that old men shiver together with junior high kids who romp around, and the local bankers rub elbows with the guy who sweeps out the store." And not surprisingly, in an era when women and minorities were underrepresented in the sciences, Moonwatch primarily was an activity for middle-class white men. There were few, if any, members of the African-American community who joined, but to be fair, blacks in the 1950s faced far more pressing civil rights issues that had to be dealt with. And while minority participation may have been sketchy, scores of women participated in Moonwatch. These women served on Moonwatch's National Advisory Committee, several women led highly successful teams, and many high school girls participated through school groups. In short, though, Moonwatch was largely a white middle-class activity. This was due in part, of course, to the cost of the equipment. To outfit a team of, say, a dozen to 15 observers cost roughly what a Studebaker would have cost in the mid-1950s. One of my favorite stories about Moonwatch comes from a team in Fort Worth, Texas. There was a team of school children there that were associated with the local Natural History Museum. And the woman who led the team, Miss Charlie Noble, they named a planetarium after her eventually, she had a very interesting library. Instead of loaning books, she loaned out telescopes to the local school children. So basically, you could join her club, you could come in and check out a telescope for a week or a month. And there were all sorts of interesting correspondence about the kids who were checking these telescopes out and learning how to do amateur astronomy and, in many ways, becoming quite good at it. So in the fall of 1956 and all through 1957, Moonwatch teams formed all around the world. By 1958, the Smithsonian had registered 230 teams with some 8,000 people signed up. And these Moonwatch teams were often objects of civic pride. Local businesses, eager to appear on technology's cutting edge, touted their support of satellite spotting teams. In Phoenix, for example, Valley National Bank bragged about its Moonwatch sponsorship in press releases that it sent out to local papers and allowed amateurs to use the bank's roof as their base of operations. Ironically, however, the satellite spotters became victim of the bank's success. The bank eventually decided to erect a giant revolving neon sign on its roof, forcing the team to seek a darker location. But there's all sorts of wonderful ephemera from this. You know, somebody's membership card, the letterhead from the team in San Fernando Valley. This is probably my favorite. This is from a team in Terre Haute, Indiana. Obviously had a very creative designer involved there. You know, the teams have put together newsletters such as this, the Orbituarian, which shows a preacher actually standing over the graves of Sputnik 1 and Sputnik 2 after they had re-entered the atmosphere. The Smithsonian was especially keen to promote Moonwatch in countries where it was going to build these Baker Nun camera stations, and amateurs in Argentina, Australia, and Japan, and other countries all organized teams as well. For example, in South America, news about Moonwatch was translated by the Smithsonian into Spanish, and then this was disseminated to many of the local teams. But of all the overseas amateur participation, Japan was the place that actually responded the most. Over 24 groups initially signed up for Moonwatch, and by the time the IGY was in full swing, there were over 70 teams in Japan taking part. And like in the U.S., Japanese teams were staffed by enthusiastic teens and science amateurs, and they were often sponsored by local newspapers, their activities centrally coordinated by the Tokyo Astronomical Observatory, with the results then sent off then to Cambridge. The Smithsonian Archives in Washington, D.C. has a tremendous wealth of material all about this program. It was just absolutely fascinating to go through. And in looking through it, you can learn quite a bit about the individual teams and the people who led those teams. I'd like to spend just a few minutes talking about the life of one team leader, a woman by the name of Viola Heffernan. One of the unfortunate features of professional science in the 1950s is that there was a relative lack of opportunity for women participants. The career of Viola Heffernan, who was one of Moonwatch's longest-serving team leaders, provides a different perspective. Born in 1907, she grew up in New Mexico. Her mother was one of the first women physicians in the state. She first appreciated the joys of stargazing by going out at night with her grandfather, and eventually moved to Albuquerque in 1928 and took a degree in history at the University of New Mexico. After graduating, she worked teaching in several small, hardscrabble New Mexico towns. She got married, but her husband died young during the Second World War, and she returned to Albuquerque and earned a second history degree. She never remarried. Instead, she poured her energy into her students' lives. For example, all throughout her teaching career, her apartment was within walking distance to the high school where she taught. And at Albuquerque High School, Heffernan first taught history and geography. But in the 1950s, she was looking for a new challenge, and she began to offer a general science course geared toward the school's academic underachievers. Over time, her science students improved, and she became increasingly interested in incorporating more astronomy into her teaching. In 1954, with the donation of an old telescope, she started an astronomy club. The roof of the high school, four stories off the ground, became the club's headquarters for almost two decades. And when the Smithsonian unveiled the Moonwatch program in 1956, Heffernan's students eagerly signed up. sponsorship from a local bank and monthly membership dues of 25 cents helped pay for equipment and operating costs and the green and silver shoulder patches that her team members proudly wore on their jackets as if they were high school athletes. But in order for Moonwatch to be accepted by professional astronomers, Fred Whipple first had to overcome his colleagues' skepticism. Professional scientists were worried that ordinary people might not be up to the task, or that the whole IGY program might somehow be construed as an amateurish activity, or that IGY professional activities might be overwhelmed with data sent in from all around the planet from these amateur teams. And to help overcome this bias, these Moonwatch teams educated themselves about astronomy, and they also took part in nationwide practice alerts, which Whipple's observatory planned throughout the summer of 1957. To help simulate a satellite aircraft borrowed from the Civil Air Patrol would trail a long length of clothesline behind it, to which a toilet plunger, delicately referred to in press coverage as a rubber plumber's helper, was tied. And when pulled along at a slow speed at an altitude of about a mile and a quarter, the plunger, fitted with a small light bulb and a few batteries, looked roughly equal to what people imagined a satellite passing overhead would look. And these amateur teams would go out on these practice alerts and practice spotting it. Not everyone was thrilled by these drills. In New Orleans, the police arrested one volunteer pilot after his slow, low passes over the city alarmed residents. The pilot, upon landing, explained to authorities that he was flying an official mission for Moonwatch. Unconvinced, the police booked him for drunken driving, and they cited his passenger for loitering. So it goes. All of this training came to fruition in October of 1957, when a Soviet rocket took off from what today is Kazakhstan. After a five-minute burn, the engine shut down, the protective nose cone opened up to allow a 23-inch, 184-pound metal sphere to tumble out. And together, the rocket body, the nose cone, and Sputnik 1 itself entered orbit. The Soviets actually entered the space age with three satellites, not one. Four long spring-loaded antennae popped into place. Battery power transmitters inside the pressurized metal shell began to send that familiar beep, beep, beep signal. And when news of the Soviet launch appeared in the United States the evening of October 4th, 1957, there was great chaos at Fred Whipple's observatory. He arrived back at the office after hearing the news and found hordes of press and radio and TV people in such a blaze of lights that one concerned citizen of Cambridge thought the building was in flames and called the fire department. But more seriously, however, for Whipple's plans, the official visual tracking system that he had been depending upon, the professional tracking system, was not yet completed. So spotting the first satellites would depend on the amateurs. And across the globe, teams sprang into action after getting phone calls from the Smithsonian or hearing about the news on the radio. In Albuquerque, for example, Viola Heffron's team got a phone call from Cambridge about 4:30 that afternoon, and they immediately started calling their team together. This was difficult because it was a Friday evening. Her team was composed of teenagers, and they all had to cancel dates for that evening's homecoming game. But by 6:30, her team was on the roof of the high school, and they started to scan the skies for Sputnik. But due to the particular details of Sputnik's orbit, the first sightings of it would be done by moonwatchers in Australia. Amateurs in the United States would have to wait a few extra days for the satellite's path to take it over the United States at dusk or dawn when it was most easily visible. But finally, on October 10th, a telephone engineer standing watch in New Haven, Connecticut, shouted, "I got it!" into the chilly morning air as the bright rocket body sailed into his telescope's field of view, and he became the first confirmed U.S. sighting. Viola Heffron's team reported theirs soon after. Using these sightings to calculate reliable orbits was challenging, but with enough accurate sightings of the booster rocket, scientists at the Smithsonian Observatory and MIT generated orbital predictions. This was heralded by the news media, which was hungry, of course, for any glimmer of a U.S. response to the Soviet accomplishment. And over the next several weeks, this scene was repeated around the planet as teams from the United States, Australia, Japan reported seeing one of the new satellites. In all, over 130 teams and countless other people around the planet saw the rocket body before it re-entered the atmosphere and disintegrated in early December. these Moonwatch sightings, coupled with accurate computer calculation, enabled the news media to tell the public when they could go outside and perhaps see Sputnik. In some newspapers, for example, satellite observing times appear next to the weather forecast for several months. Love this picture. Moonwatch offered amateurs a way to directly engage with the public about science. Moonwatch team leaders, in effect, became public information officers for their local communities. As volunteers, the start of the space age was very hectic indeed for them. One Chicago group logged more than 200 phone calls from concerned and interested citizens in a six-hour period as one of the Sputniks was thought to be passing overhead. And these shiny new objects that were orbiting the Earth during the IGY trespassed into a region which for many had been traditionally sacred and inviolate. Outer space meant celestial space. In Harpers Ferry, West Virginia, for example, a small crowd gathered in front of the local church. They asked the minister to explain Sputnik and what it meant. Wouldn't it, for example, collide with the angels as it orbited the planet? They asked the minister. And the reverend, of course, calmly assured them that God could take care of his own, and they needn't worry about satellite-angel collisions. Public inquiries broached the bizarre at times, and Moonwatch teams received crank calls on letters on topics ranging from UFOs to the invention of anti-gravity machines. In Indianapolis, scores of people called their local Moonwatch team leader after the rocket body passed overhead, one citizen claiming to the local newspaper that it flew by so close, quote, she could hear the motor running. And indeed, after Sputnik's launch, the number of flying saucer sightings spiked with more than 700 reported just in the last 3 months of 1957 alone. And as amateurs played an important role in explaining the science behind satellites, they got very creative. Here's a team member of the Walnut Creek, California team showing off an instrument that his Moonwatch team had built. With the aid of some gears and pulleys, their so-called satellarium, much like an old-fashioned orrery, moved a globe and satellite combination around to explain concepts such as apogee and perigee and orbit to a public that was just beginning to learn these new words. The Walnut Creek team achieved maximum crowd-pleasing effects by unveiling their satellarium show with a launch countdown and a space-age soundtrack. They displayed their invention to local TV shows, to schools and civic organizations, and for a while even put it in the display window of a local department store. For several months, Moonwatcher's participation proved especially critical to the success of the IGY's satellite program. Satellite tracking also helped make Fred Whipple a celebrity. After Sputnik, newspaper and TV reporters sought him out for information on all aspects of space travel. A Life magazine reporter asked him, for example, what would life be like on spaceships or other planets? One writer wanted to know what people would wear in outer space. And Whipple, of course, obliged and wrote back that magnetic shoes might be useful on future spaceships, but tight-fitting outfits would be the norm because you wouldn't want all that free-floating cloth around. As he said, the matter simply becomes one for Christian Dior. It's not a scientific problem. But in his scientific talks, Whipple explained how the motion of artificial satellites was affected by the Earth's deviation from a perfect spherical shape. He explained the effect of atmosphere drag on satellites. And by establishing precise orbits of satellites, astronomers began to more accurately measure things such as the density and temperature of the upper atmosphere, the shape of the Earth, and the variation of the Earth's gravitational field. Smithsonian scientists, for example, use Moonwatch observations to conclude the relative amounts of solar particles versus radiation, the degree to which they heated the upper atmosphere. And the observed reentry of satellites like Sputnik 2 in April of 1958, when it plunged back to Earth and was visible all up and down the eastern seaboard, helped scientists and military researchers get a sense of how ICBM warheads might behave as they pass back through the upper atmosphere. And much as Whipple had planned, satellite tracking helped both the staff and budget numbers of his observatory to increase. This trend only accelerated after NASA was formed in 1958, and the SAO, the Smithsonian Observatory, was given valuable contracts by NASA for visual satellite tracking all throughout the 1960s. Other organizations experienced growth as well. A boom in membership for amateur science clubs accompanied public interest in astronomy and satellite spotting, and just as amateur scientists and other curiosity seekers wanted to see satellites, many more people wanted to know how they got up there in the first place. So there was a huge resurgence also in model rocketry and amateur rocket clubs as well. Moonwatch in general helped strengthen the networks of amateur scientists around the country and around the world. And of course, after the shock of Sputnik, journalists and politicians called for improved science education and demanded more scientists and engineers. As one teacher phrased it, science has now become the main battleground of the Cold War. The promotion of amateur science activities among teens and young adults was another way to enhance national security and economic competitiveness. As one teenager in a letter that he sent to Fred Whipple at the Smithsonian, he recalled how when he was a kid, he had visited Kitty Hawk Hill, where the Wright brothers first flew, and that had first sparked his fascination with space flight. But now he had moved on, and Moonwatch was part of the way in which he saw he could, quote, fulfill his responsibility as an American citizen by helping the government, and I'm also participating in an activity in which I'm very much interested. And statements like this reveal how moonwatching, for some, seamlessly combines civic duty, enthusiasm for science, and a certain amount of Cold War vigilance. Throughout the 1960s, satellites became increasingly common. In fact, we have so much of our lives depends on them today that we don't even think about them. GPS, weather forecasting, satellite radio. You know, we don't give satellites really a moment's thought. And of course, during the 1960s, this was a period where they made the transformation from novelty to sort of everyday taken-for-granted object. And of course, the U.S. and the Soviets launched scores of satellites during the 60s to spy on each other and conduct scientific observations, to foster communications and weather forecasting. And as more satellites were launched, moonwatchers continued to improve their skills and regularly sent thousands of observations to the Smithsonian every year. Recognition for their efforts came in many forms. If you were a moonwatcher during the IGY, you would have been given this pin. President Eisenhower in 1958 sent a personal telegram to the Smithsonian Observatory, which was then relayed to moonwatch teams all around the world, in which Eisenhower thanks the amateur scientists for the contributions that they were making. And that, of course, perhaps most importantly to many of the amateur scientists, professional scientists were using the data that they collected as part of a larger research program. As time went by, as I said, those satellites became less of a novelty, and Moonwatch became less about community involvement and less about the layperson's enthusiasm for science and technology. The program continued for another 20 years. But while most people remember the 1960s for their social and political unrest, it was during that time that scientists and engineers wove satellites into a revolutionary new infrastructure that enabled communication and research and surveillance. But also it was during this period that Moonwatch evolved more from a civic and education-based activity to one that really appealed to hardcore amateur scientists. So sort of the joyriders, if you will, sort of dropped away from the program after about 1958. But it sort of kept this kernel for another two decades of people who were really interested in this. They were dedicated amateur scientists, amateur astronomers, and they were perfectly willing to go out at odd hours of the early morning or night to carry out their observations. However, even as satellites ceased being a novelty and the public's attention shifted to new fads, Moonwatch still continued to attract young people who were excited about science and the space age. One of these was a teenager from Albuquerque named Joel Weisberg. As a young boy growing up in Albuquerque, Weisberg followed Heffron's activities with keen interest. Born in 1950, he later remembered when I interviewed him how his parents took him to Kirtland Air Force Base. His father was a member of the local Civil Air Patrol to watch Sputnik 1's rocket body pass overhead. He was a good cold warrior, he recalled when I spoke with him, and he recalled how his curiosity about the Soviet space program, along with his interest in science, brought him to the Moonwatch program. He participated in Viola Heffron's program as a teenager and used his activities to compete in a state science fair, which he did very well, and he also used this as part of his application to MIT. He studied astronomy there, later went on to get his PhD, and after teaching for 3 years or so at Princeton University, he then moved to Carleton College, a small liberal arts college in Minneapolis, to what he called his dream job that let him combine teaching with research and working with small groups of students. And when I asked him about the effect that amateur science had on his life, he gave a very simple yet accurate assessment. He just simply said, "Look at me. I'm an astronomer." You know, for him, that was enough, that his activities, his participation in this, directly led to him picking a particular professional path and one in which he was quite satisfied with. Dependent on public funding and interest and support, Moonwatch's past accomplishments and the continued participation of a small but devoted core of amateurs was not enough to sustain it forever. In June 1975, after 19 years and collecting some 400,000 observations, the Moonwatch program came to an end. Its legacy, however, remains in today's science fairs, amateur scientist groups, and in amateur professional science collaborations that are especially strong in fields like ornithology, meteorology, and astronomy. However, there's some interesting historical irony here. Amateur science was encouraged very much in the 1950s. However, after 9/11, model rocketry groups were discouraged from participating in their activity. The sale of model rocket engines is now regulated by the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms folks. I don't know if any of you have bought a chemistry set for a child or grandkid or nephew. It's a far cry from the ones that I had as a kid, and I'm sure it's a far cry from the ones that you could get in the 1950s. This is one. Childproof test tubes it has, experiments involve no flame, and as I recall, the most radical chemical that you could get in this kit was some cornstarch. And even that was labeled maybe potential hazard, just, you know, covering your bases. And in sort of a final historical irony, as I said, of course, during the Cold War, amateur satellite spotters were encouraged by the government to participate. The group of people that are still participating in this activity are, not surprisingly, especially intrigued with tracking classified reconnaissance satellites these days. And with the availability of the internet, they post the results of their observations on the web. This has prompted at least one senator to complain in public that they posed a threat to national security and that amateur satellite spotting should be actively discouraged because it was allowing people who were carrying out operations and activities and that we might be interested in spying on from carrying out those activities at times when they knew when the reconnaissance satellites would be passing overhead and doing it at a different time. So the irony is indeed quite rich. It's another photograph that I like. When I was doing this project, Joel Weisberg, the person I mentioned, sent me a wonderful box of material, and tucked away in the bottom of the box was a little plastic container, and I opened it up and this charm bracelet came out. And it was a bracelet that Weisberg and his fellow classmates gave to her, to Viola Heffron, when she retired from teaching in 1972. And it's fantastic because it has all these wonderful icons of the space age. You know, the Saturn rocket, and the V2 rocket here somewhere, and the little talisman for the Mercury 7, and, you know, the Moonwatch 1958 to 1972, the years that she participated. Sort of a wonderful little bit of ephemera that survives from this period. Moonwatch provided these citizen scientists an opportunity to experience science and bring it to the wider public. Thousands of people participated, and as I said, they were not simply passive data collectors. They refined their equipment, they trained themselves, they built new equipment, they formed new networks to communicate their work, and the influence that they had extended beyond simply the data that they collected. They helped stimulate amateur science and interest in science and space among ordinary citizens. And I think it's fair to say that today, the health of science depends on public support and interest, and amateurs can help build this foundation and temper the tendency towards over-specialization that can sometimes estrange science from the broader public. Today, of course, we face profound issues, climate change, energy needs, even politicians who reject established scientific concepts. And in such times, the appreciation and understanding of science is too important to be left just to the professionals. And the amateurs of programs like Moonwatch provided an important bridge between professionals and interested citizens. And one can only hope that others will step up to the telescopes, the microscopes, and the ham radios and take their place. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Frederick. So as always, we are now open for questions. Now, normally someone runs around with a mic, but this is a small room and you can all hear me without a mic. So I think the questions can be heard as well, and I'll therefore just leave it to you.
Okay. In the back, you have one.
Not really a question, but an observation. Having lived through that era, and I can remember our freshman astronomy class at Berkeley being led to the observatory to watch Sputnik going over, and then doing the calculations for orbits. It was my impression during the 60s that NASA and the armed forces really discouraged a lot of people. They made, you know, they made the whole thing overly technical, very secretive. They created all this jargon that turned off a lot of people, basically said amateurs were not welcome. This is something that only we with uniforms and stripes on our sleeves can understand it. I hope that doesn't happen again.
Well, I can't speak to that per se, but one of the trends which I was trying to identify here is that as Moonwatch itself went on, its members began to see themselves as different from the regular amateur astronomy community. I mean, the work that they were doing was, you know, highly precise, involved a lot of very complex calculations, and there was a tendency, even among the amateur scientists, to unfortunately discourage general participation because, you know, they had their program, they were contributing to professional scientists' work, and that was a large feature of their credibility, and they didn't want to go back to the days of 1957 and 58 where anybody could participate. So there was a tendency toward that.
Did anybody mention in your work one of the things that I remember we were all suspected of being potential peeping Toms with our telescopes and were frequently warned to stay away from residential areas at nighttime?
There were a few anecdotes about more of the opposite. It was teenagers who really had to convince their parents to let them out at night to go do this because, of course, this was also an era where there was a lot of concern about delinquency. And, you know, not all parents understood what their kids were up to. So if you explain to your parents, you know, hey, I'm not coming home till 4 this morning. There was a question over here. Yes.
Do you see any organizations or activities today that could be a seed that starts a renewal of this type of activity?
There are isolated groups. The thing that really struck me about Moonwatch and why I became so interested in it was that it was a global program and that it was a very standardized and organized program. If you were participating in it, everyone had roughly the same type of equipment. You were organized for a common purpose. If you were a Moonwatcher from New Mexico and you met, you know, someone from Cambridge, Massachusetts who was doing the same thing, you were sort of roughly on the same wavelength, and the same for people who were participating overseas. You know, there are organizations today like the American Association of Variable Star Observers, bird watching groups. I mean, there are sort of these little pockets of very intense amateur science activity. But the thing that struck me about Moonwatch, of course, was its global scope and the fact that in many cases the people were observing the same thing. You know, if you're a weather observer, you know, what you're seeing in Cape May, New Jersey is not what someone in Albuquerque is observing. But if you're observing Sputnik 1, you're seeing the same thing just at different parts of the planet. I think that was part of its appeal, was that the people who were participating felt like they were participating in something that transcended just their own local circumstances. Yeah.
I was just trying to ask you also whether you would speculate on amateur or public participation in science or science-related activities like this in other fields. Astronomy is something, of course, which some level, it's easy to
learn.
And chemistry, as you talked about, electronics was another example.
Mm-hmm.
Those have been.
I mean, ornithology has a particularly long tradition of this, going back into the 19th century. Interestingly, in the 19th century, the Smithsonian had a national program of volunteer weather observers. And although I don't think Fred Whipple was aware of it, many of the steps that he took place, he carried out in the 1950s, were retracing what people had done in the mid-19th century to establish a network of people who would collect weather observations, funnel them all into D.C. to go into the preparation of weather almanacs and all that. But since you mentioned something you said reminded me, one of the things that is also interesting is you think about the opportunities for amateur scientists. How many of you remember Heathkits? Is the Heath Company still in business? No, they went under about 12 years ago. And one of the complaints that the owner of the Heathkit Company made as they were closing their doors was that for a long time, people who were interested in computers could build their own computers. But as the cost of computers came down and as the technology became more complex, the people instead were just buying a computer off the shelf. And instead of directing their amateur efforts towards the computer itself, we're directing it towards the World Wide Web, making web pages, doing all that sort of stuff online, as opposed to actually doing the hardware. So, question in the back.
I just thought about one area you haven't mentioned, and I just came to my mind because of an article recently, human bison.
Yeah.
You claimed that maybe biology, or microbiology,
yeah,
into the stage where it will become an amateur science.
Yeah. Botany, of course, would be another thing that botany would be a wonderful example also of another activity that engaged amateurs considerably. You and then you.
I know when I was in Asia, like some of the small observatories, they participate all around the world with doing the latitude and longitude for the weather, for the timing. The international time.
I have to confess, it's not something I know much about, that aspect of it. But one of the things, of course, that these smaller observatories are beginning to do is by the fact that they can be controlled remotely and they can be used in real time via the web, that does provide another opportunity for amateur astronomers, sort of come back to that example. Yes?
Is there ever a report done in the end as to how much use was made of the data and how much was just sort of public make work, put it that way?
That's a good question. And it was one that I never really fully arrived for myself at a satisfactory answer. The Smithsonian scientists during the 1960s produced several models of the Earth, which they used, I think it was called the Smithsonian Standard Earth. And the Moonwatch data was used in that. I think what ended up happening with the data was that it tended to sort of be combined with the professional tracking data, and then it just kind of went into whatever particular research project scientists were working on. I do know that the scientists, particularly those who worked at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, did try to take pains to, in the credits or thanks or whatever of their papers and publications, at least acknowledge the work that the amateurs had done. Interestingly enough, the amateurs themselves, I never, in all of the documents I looked at, really got a sense that they were particularly concerned that their work be used for specific research applications. The general sense that I had in looking at their correspondence was that they were just simply happy to be participating, that if they were making any small contribution, that this was worth the effort that they were putting into, and that really seemed to be the focus of their effort. Yes?
I remember when Sputnik came along, the LA City school system went hysterical. We had science twice a day. We had problem sets in math, third grade, fourth grade.
Yeah.
We had shop class. We put all our electronic projects together in shop class, junior high school. Is there a way maybe that the college system can affect primary education toward that again, because kids get nothing like that.
I'm a historian. I'm sorry, I'm way out of my hair.
that they can't, from the top down, encourage elementary and secondary schools to bring science and shop back.
One thought I had as I was writing the last chapter of the book, because I was trying to bring some of this into the present day, and the one thing that struck me, and again, I don't have kids. It's been a long time since I had a high school science class, so all the information I get is just hearing, colleagues and friends and their anecdotes about their own kids.
My wife's a teacher, so I have
But the thing that really struck me in hearing some of these anecdotes and thinking about this was one of the things also, in addition to Moonwatch being this global project that people were simultaneously participating in, was that it was a very active, hands-on sort of activity. And this year, for example, is the International Heliophysical Year, which is a even grander version of the IGY. And I contacted them several times to see what programs they had for schools and amateur scientists, and the answers I got weren't entirely helpful. But the general sense that I got is that they were encouraging a lot of web-based education, that you could log on and see a scientist working at the North Pole, for example. And the thing that struck me was that it was sort of a return to this passive model again, where you're sort of watching somebody else doing it and thinking, talking about it, whatever, as opposed to learning it yourself, making mistakes, screwing up, ruining your first telescope mirror and building another one, that sort of thing. And that to me seemed to be the real difference, was the hands-on part. Yes?
The program, I think, kind of speaks to several of these issues. It was partly instituted here at UCSB. It's called Project Budburst. It's a phenology program to look at when different plants go through their different stages of phenology.
Yeah.
And it's to allow people all over the country to look at the effects of global warming on what's happening.
Yeah. That makes me think of the Audubon Society has its annual Christmas bird count, which is kind of a similar thing.
It's aimed at kids, a lot of it, so it kind of speaks to that. And I think there are a few other things that happen along that line. Yeah.
There was a question. Yes.
Yeah, another interesting way of getting kids interested in science is to actually go to a cultural sciences practice and become friends with scientists. And this happened in 1954. I was a member of the Valley Astronomical Society, and we were up at Mount Wilson. One of our dads took us up there. We were up by the 60-foot solar tower, and this guy comes out and he says, "Hey, who are you?" Comes up.
Yeah.
It was Joe Hickok, who was a very interesting character. He was the chief solar observational astronomer for about 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
He took us on a trip to every telescope, the 100-inch, the 60-inch, the two solar towers, the Snow Telescope, which had been abandoned for 20 years. And not only that, but he welcomed us back. And so for several years, up through when I was in college, I'd go up and visit him.
Something similar happened.
To meet scientists, he would take this up, and I met George Abel, who ultimately became a teacher of mine.
I used his textbook as an undergrad, but something similar happened to me in the 1980s. I was a high school student, was interested in science, and I ended up working with a biologist at the local college. I didn't end up becoming a biologist because he gave me the job of dissecting the dead frogs, frankly, and that kind of turned me off to that. But I did get to see how biology was practiced and chose not to do it. Yes.
I just want to offer an International Year of Astronomy is 2009, and the international astronomical community, which is it's growing and growing and growing, especially the amateur group, which is everywhere. So there's now, even here in Santa Barbara, the Las Cumbres astronomical group, they're going to have 19 telescopes all around the world so that any classroom anywhere in the world can do hands-on astronomy by going into the web. And the Astronomical Society of the Pacific up in San Francisco. But there's huge, huge amounts of things being done for the public. People are going from just nearby here to find the first moment of 2009. It's huge. If you go to the web and look up International IYA 2009.
I hope all these people buy my book. That'd be great.
A lot of them will.
Let's have one more question. I have to actually teach tomorrow morning, so. Yes.
For 12 hours every day, he had a two-hour watch, so there were six people every night in the station upstate New York at the university, and those were all over the country.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody ever saw anything. Friendly airplane, right? Delighted when we saw a friendly airplane and we could report it.
And as someone who was born much after that, I have to say I'm kind of happy you didn't see many Soviet aircraft. Thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. You had an announcement. Yes.
There are, as usual, refreshments.